let's get down to Perek Lamed Gimel, chapter 33, which again, I thought was going to be an easy breeze and that's it, and there's so much here. I thought I was gonna just fly through this chapter. This is the last of the hoys. If you look on the sheet at source number 9, I gave you the structure of the chapter. It begins with a promise. Hashem is going to fight off the despoiler. Somebody who had taken loot from us, Hashem is going to fight them off and save us. Then we find the description briefly of somebody suffering or somebody having suffered, and it's not clear whom, we have to talk about that. Before Hashem promises once again, I'm going to destroy the despoiler. You will have a just and righteous leader who is going to save you. And by the way, there are going to be rivers outside of Yerushalayim and boats won't be able to cross them. Which seems to be fairly random and kind of out of nowhere. So the questions you saw already, you saw the preparation questions that I gave you. The biggest question is, what does this have to do with the other hoys that we talked about before? And the answer is a lot. Who is the despoiler? When is the downfall of this despoiler? Who is it who is in ruins in the middle of the chapter? Who are we talking about? And who is this remarkable just leader who's going to save us? So first of all, the despoiler. So this already, you've done enough Yeshaya to know that you're going to have two different views here. One view that it is Sanherib. The Assyrian Empire has crushed the northern kingdom. They've conquered cities in the southern kingdom. And God is saying he's going to defeat them. And that's clearly one approach. And then the other approach is that it's actually a projection forward to the time of Mashiach. And the despoiler is whoever's been harming us at that period in time. Right? I mean, I think that we could have figured out. The Gemara in Sanhedrin is in source number 11. And I bring it to you for two reasons. The Gemara there is asking how Hashem struck the Assyrians. All we're going to find out is that they wake up in the morning and the Assyrians are dead. But we don't know what happened to them. So the Gemara goes through all sorts of explanations for what happened to the Assyrians. One explanation is the one that we saw, and I referenced earlier, about how they heard the song of the Chayot. And then the other one is that that the scythe of Gavriel strikes them. Both of those are linked to Psukim in Yeshaya. But the second one that's brought here, the one about the Song of the Chayot, comes from our chapter. So the Gemara is taking our chapter as referring to the killing of the Assyrian forces. You follow? I'm just bringing that in order to show you that the Gemara takes our chapter as referring to the fall of the Assyrians. However, Radak, and by the way, Ibn Ezra and Malbim take it that way also. Radak, on the other hand, says it could be about that, about Chizkiyahu's time and Sanherib and the Assyrians, but it could also be about the time of Mashiach and whoever is our enemy at that time. It works either way. If you take a look at the chapter itself on page 1009, just look at the opening two sentences. I'm going to read out of the English. Woe to you, pillager, either Assyria or our enemy in the future, but you have not been pillaged. Nothing's happened to you yet. Traitor who has not been betrayed yet. When you finish pillaging, you will be pillaged. When you end your treachery, they will be treacherous with you. And then there is a tefillah, there is a prayer from the Navi, from the prophet, or describing how the righteous will pray, saying, Hashem, grant us favor, we have hoped for you. Be their strong arm every morning, also our salvation in the time of distress, either distress from the Assyrians, or from this ultimate time, the time that precedes Mashiach. So the chapter begins with a promise that Hashem is going to take down the enemy who harms us, whether it's the Assyrians or someone we haven't met yet, Gog and Magog, whatever, in the time of Mashiach. But then in sentence 7, you get this difficult part. It's really the only difficult part of the chapter. Reading it here, Hein Erelamza Kuchutza. So your main problem is the word Erel, which is not a usual word. Hein Erelam. Tzaku chutza. We used to have Arela, who used to sit next to you. So that was her name. This Arel of somebody, their Arel, cried out chutzah in the streets, Malachei Shalom, which sounds like angels of peace, Maryiv Kayun, they cry bitterly. The roads are destroyed, no one is able to pass, the covenant has been broken, everybody is mourning and grieving, the Sharon is in ruins, right? That's your passage. So the question is, who exactly is in ruins here? How does this fit the context when we're talking about our redemption? Right? This is supposed to be a happy chapter. Why is this mess stuck here in the middle? This business about the Sharon being in ruins, the Er-Elim, whoever they are, crying, the Malachim of peace crying. It's very difficult. People look at this in advance. Did anyone get a chance to see this?
Yeah.
Read it through. Okay, that's something. I'm sure she is happy. Yes.
Can this be what the redemption was from?
So that's certainly one view. One view is that this is past tense, and it's describing the Jews who had suffered in their ruins. They have already mourned their losses under the Assyrians or in our long exile, depending again on when you believe this whole thing is happening. That was the view I was going to present second. But now I'll present it first, because it came up first. According to this view, and I didn't want to spend a lot of time trying to bring you text, because we would never finish this chapter. So if you take a look at source number 14, approach number 2, tears of the Jews under Assyria, or, again, in the long exile, depending on which view you take, but it's describing past tense what happened. According to this, what is Er Elam? It is their altar, their Mizbeach, according to Rashi. Remember, we saw Hoy Ariel Ariel. Ariel was the Mizbeach, was the altar. So Rashi says, that's what Er Elam is, their Mizbeach. We grieved for the destruction of the temple, of the Beis HaMikdash and the Mizbeach. Radak says, no, Er Elim are Malachim, they're angels. Sorry? Yeah. Yes, well, in the Tamatali Yerusha, but yeah. That's the way Radak takes it. Radak says it's their malach. Sorry, Ora, you were going to say?
I'm saying that migrant,
they stay
Elahem.
Right, Elahem, right. That is another view. We're not there. But Abarbanel offers the idea that it's the general malachim, not their malach. Er Elam, but he reads it as though it was Er Elim, that the Malachim are crying because of our suffering when we are in exile. If you think of the Medrash about Rabbi Akiva, how the Malachim cried when Rabbi Akiva was suffering. There's a Gemara in Chagiga. So Rashi, Radak, Abarbanel all render this Er Elam as the crying that happened because of the Mizbeach, because of our suffering, but it's a past tense type of crying. And the breach, the covenant that was violated, either was the enemy broke their covenant with us, or, take a look at Radak, I couldn't resist reading this, Radak quotes his father as saying, no, Israel said, God has already broken his covenant with us. The claim that Hefer Brit is God. Hashem has broken his covenant with us. So this is all one school of thought to what's going on here. I skipped the Ar Elahem, or just because of there are too many different approaches. I had to limit something. But another approach is that this is about the crying of the nations under the yoke of Assyria. Meaning it's not us, it's the nations. And this is Ibn Ezra's approach. Ibn Ezra says the Er Elam and Malachei Shalom are the Malachim, which could mean angels or human emissaries from the nations, who look for peace with the Assyrians and suffer. Take a look at source number 13. He only says that this is about Assyria. It's not about the long exile. To me, he says, it appears correct that Er Elam is like their malachim, which again could be human agents or it could be celestial, as testified by the context, where it also says the Malachim of peace, meaning the Malachim of every nation who will seek peace for this world will cry at the reign of Assyria, because the Assyrians are destroying them. So we have two approaches right now to who is suffering. Either the world is, or we are. Either way, it's past tense, because now God is going to end it. And then there's this wild third view from the Malbim. The Malbim says, no, there's no crying going on. We assumed that it was crying. Go back to Pasuk Zion. Hein erelam tsa'aku chutza means the agents of the Malachim of the Assyrians roared in the streets. They roar against Yerushalayim. That's the idea. He says, they roar. And that fits really well, because one of the things that we're going to see when we get to the actual Assyrian invasion is that the Assyrians send representatives to intimidate Yerushalayim. Chizkiyahu sends his men out to meet them. We talked about this way back when we talked about Shevna. So Hizkiyahu sends out his agents to talk with them. And the Assyrians talk in a very loud voice, and they talk in Hebrew. And Chizkiyahu's agents say, keep it down and talk in Aramaic. We don't want everybody overhearing. And they insist. They say, no, that's our point. That's why we're doing it. We're doing it to demoralize Yerushalayim. So they are roaring outside, Tzakuchutza, in an attempt to intimidate Yerushalayim, and the Malachi Shalom who are crying are our Malachim who we sent to sue for peace. And they're the ones who are in tears. And then Hefer Brit, they broke the covenant, is what happens when, as we'll see in Malachim Bet, in chapter 18, Chizkiyahu tries to make peace with the Assyrians. He tries to bribe Sennacherib, and they break the deal that they had with Chizkiyahu. So that's the breaking of the covenant. So three different approaches to this odd section. One approach is the nations are crying under Assyria's yoke. Number two, this is the suffering that the Jews had either under Assyria or in our long exile. And number three is that it's actually Assyria roaring in their attack on Yerushalayim, which is itself in ruins. However, all of this comes to an end when Hashem rescues us and we get this great king. Jump to sentence 15, please, the very bottom of page 1009. Everybody was afraid. Who in the world can live with this? And then you find out who can live with it. So I'm just going to do their translation here. One who walks with righteousness, speaks with truthfulness, spurns extortionate profit, shakes off his hands from holding a bribe, seals his ears from hearing of bloodshed, shuts his eyes from seeing evil. This doesn't mean see no evil, hear no evil, as we'll talk about. He shall dwell in heights, in rocky fortresses as his stronghold. His bread will be granted, his water assured. Your eyes will behold the king in his splendor. Notice that king got a capital K there. We're going to come back to that. They will see him, capital H, from a faraway land. So this is your king who is going to save you. According to most, this is a king. Ibn Ezra actually disagrees and says, no, this is describing your average citizen of Zion at that time. Okay. Who can live there? Somebody who's honest. Yeah.
You're saying, I mean...
Not the part about seeing the king.
Seems to be saying it's God, the king.
It switches gears. Go back to 15.
I mean, what I have does...
I see. So you haven't got the entire time. Okay. Yeah, now we're going to see it. I'm going to come back to it. You'll see. But the way that Ibn Ezra reads it is that actually going back to one who walks with righteousness, speaks with truthfulness, and so on, is your average citizen of Zion. That's the way that he reads this. Everybody else thinks that this is a king already from the beginning of the section. But notice sentence 17. Your eyes will behold the king in his splendor. Right? We started today by looking at chapter 30, sentence 20. V'hayu einecha ro'os es morecha, right? Your eyes will see your moreh. So, we have multiple views about what it is that you are perceiving with your moreh, and what you are perceiving here. Who is this melech you are perceiving?
I was just going to say that, but 14 kind of leads into this idea that it's all the people. Like, I mean, just reading in the English of what I have, sinners in Zion are frightened. So it sounds much more like.
Like Ebenezer.
Not just one individual.
Absolutely. Yeah. The problem that you fundamentally have in this section is that the preceding verses talk about the population, and then it goes from there to seeing your king. So the question is only, where's my transition? And that's really what, you know, where do you draw that line? But in chapter 30, sentence 20, and I gave you a table in number 17, so you don't have to even look back. We talked about seeing your moreh. And either that was God, like the Gemara in Sotah that we saw, or Chizkiyahu and his nobles who instruct you, or it's your prophets who are trying to teach you. Right? Then here, we have a similar split about who this king is, whom you perceive. Melech b'yofyo techzena inecha, see the king in his beauty. Flip to number 18. Rashi says, also, just like Rashi said back in chapter 30, that you're seeing, you're perceiving Hashem, whatever that means, so too here, he says, the melech is capital K. You are seeing God. Rashi, that's Rashi's first view. Rashi also brings another possibility, as does Radak, as does Malbim, that it is Chizkiyahu. Because again, this is talking about beating back the Assyrians. Or, says Abarbanel, maybe it's Mashiach. Because again, it could be this is talking about a future redemption. Worth noting though, let's see how good your memory is. Go back to where he described this great king. One who walks with righteousness, speaks with truthfulness, spurns profit, shakes off his hands from holding a bribe. Right? A king of justice, in other words. Where else did we see this in Yeshaya? This prediction. Not word for word. Go back to page 973. Chapter 11. The beginning of chapter 11. And the prediction of the ultimate Mashiach who will defeat the Assyrians. A staff will emerge from the stump of Jesse. A shoot will sprout from his roots. The spirit of Hashem will rest upon him. A spirit of wisdom and understanding, counsel and strength, knowledge and fear of Hashem. He will be imbued with a spirit of fear of Hashem. Will not need to judge by what his eyes see, decide by what his ears hear. He will judge the destitute with righteousness, decide with fairness for the humble of the earth. Dot, dot, dot. This was the prediction. The Assyrians will fall at the hand of a king who will impose justice. You follow? So that's what we're seeing here. What we're getting here is the same vision as what we saw back in Perek Yud Aleph. The difference is that Perek Yud Aleph was speaking to Ahaz. Now we're already in the time of Chizkiyahu. Yeshaya is consistent. He says, it's the same thing I said back then. Same idea. He's speaking to a different king. He's speaking to a different audience. But he's saying the same thing that he said all along. What you need is a leader who is going to impose justice. That's the idea. Take a look at Pasuk Yud-Chet, please. We're back now in chapter 33. So you want page 1011. As a result of beholding this king, it then says, your heart will muse in dread. Where is the one who counts? Where is the one who weighs? Where is the one who counts the towers? What in the world are you talking about? What does that have to do with anything? So either this is talking about what you endured in the past, when you were in exile, or when you were oppressed, you expressed this kind of fear. Take a look at source number 19. Abarbanel does a nice job summing this up. He says, he, meaning the Jews, was afraid, speaking fearfully constantly due to the weight of the taxes he paid in exile, saying, where is the scribe who records the headcount? Where is the one who takes the money from our hands? I.e. Shokel, right? The one who takes the money. And because the owners of towers were the ones appointed over this among the nations, he said, where is the scribe of the towers? Soferet HaMegdalim? Or, alternatively, the one who counts the towers and the wealthy of the towers who are going to receive the burden of the taxes. So they're either the ones who are taxing or the ones who are taxed. And then he quotes you the Gemara in Chagiga. He says Megillah, but he means Chagiga. Which says that what we cried about when we were in exile was that we were missing the Sofer. Sofer meaning the Talmid Chacham, the sage who knew the Torah. The Shokel, the one who weighs words with wisdom and comprehension. The one who counts the towers, meaning records the great words like Ezra and the other leaders of Israel. So, Abarbanel understands that what we're talking about is, you're going to have this great leader who's going to bring in justice. Remember how you used to be afraid when you were in exile and you said, where are those people? They're going to be coming any minute. They're going to take all of our property. Or, woe is us, we have lost our sages, we have lost our scholars. You with me? I'm going a little fast, and maybe I'm going a little too fast here. Again, we started our chapter with a promise that the despoiler, either in the future time of Mashiach, Gog and Magog, or now, the time of the Assyrian invasion, is himself going to fall. We described how Israel is in ruins, which was either a memory of what happened under the Assyrians, or, alternatively, it's the nations suffering under the Assyrians, or, alternatively, it's not about that. It's about the Assyrians roaring against us. And yes, we are in ruins. I mean, it all comes back to this destruction. And then he said, you will be led to victory, you will be led to salvation under a king who will bring justice, which could be Chizkiyahu against the Assyrians, or could be Mashiach in the future, or the king you are going to see is actually Hashem, as Rashi reads it. But then it said, you're going to be afraid. Where does this fear come from? So Abarbanel says, it's the fear that you experienced when you were living under the enemy. Fear of their tax collectors, or fear of the loss of our sages. However, Rashi and Malbim say no. This is the fear, it's not fear exactly, it's shock, that you're going to have in the future when you see your king, your righteous king, or when you see God. Rashi says, take a look at source number 20, you're asking these questions not about us, but about the enemy. Where is all the power that they had? It's all gone. When you see the idolaters, nobles, and sages who ruled in their lives and are now judged in Gehinnom, right, tough to ask, we said, your heart will speak fearfully, saying, where is their knowledge and greatness? Where are they now? Those people who were so big. That's why Rashi takes it. Malbim has another take. I didn't translate it here in number 21 because I was trying to fit it all on the pages. But Malbim says, you'll be afraid of Sancheirev, meaning you're going to ask, how can my king possibly combat them? Even if he's a king of justice, how can he really defeat them? How does he have the number of armies that you need to have? How does he have the money that's required in order to be able to fight this war? How is it that he's going to have the towers that are necessary to defend us? Ibn Ezra has a whole other approach to this, but I think I gave you enough approaches. I didn't think that we needed another approach. I think we're good. But this is the vision of a great king who is going to lead us, and either lead us despite the fear we felt from the Assyrians, or lead us, and therefore we'll be shocked at the downfall of the enemy. Are we good? Are we? I mean, no, I can slow down and repeat again and find other ways to say if we're not getting it. Okay, the last part of this chapter, and then we get to the theme, is there's a new kind of moat. Sentences 21 to 24, the last four sentences. Look at this. For only there, this is talking about when we've been redeemed. For only there will Hashem be our mighty one. It will be like a place of wide rivers and channels. A boat cannot traverse it, and a mighty vessel cannot cross it. For Hashem is our judge. Hashem is our lawgiver. Hashem is our king. He will save us. Your ropes have been abandoned. Your ropes, meaning the ropes of the enemy, have been abandoned. They will not firmly secure their mast. They will not spread sail. Then abundant spoils and plunder will be distributed. Even the lame will take booty. So there's going to be a time when great rivers are going to surround Jerusalem such that boats can't cross them. They're going to abandon the ropes of the boats. They're going to abandon the mast on which they would have spread their sails. And we who have been weak are going to divide their loot as spoils. We also saw back in chapter 30, sentence 25, the idea of water knocking down the enemy's migdalim, the enemy's towers. But I think this is really interesting. What's the image here? This water around Yerushalayim.
Protection.
A moat, right. It's a moat of protection, right? I mean, that part, I think, is clear. But we've seen water and Yerushalayim before. I mean, remember, Yerushalayim always has a water problem, right? You're at the top of a mountain. You did not have a lot of water resources within the city. That's why it was vulnerable to siege. You had almost nothing from the city itself. So Rashi connects this with some water that we've seen before. Jump to Yechezkel, Ezekiel, chapter 47. It is page 1325. Yechezkel has a vision of the future Beis HaMikdash, the temple. Remember, he is speaking while the Jews are in exile between the first and second temples. So look at what he says. He has a vision. He's being shown things. Then he returned me to the entrance of the temple, and water was emerging from under the threshold of the temple going eastward, for the house faces eastward. The water ran down from under the right side of the temple, south of the altar. Right? And he goes on to describe this water and how it's the ankle-deep water and then knee-deep water and then waist-deep water and a stream you can't cross coming out of the Beis HaMikdash, coming out of the temple. Right? You see it? So Rebecca was here when we did Treyasar. And so she remembers that Yechezkel is not the only one. Yoel, chapter 4, sentence 18. So now you want to go ahead to Treyasar. Specifically, page 1355. Chapter 4, sentence 18. Right? It shall be on that day the mountains will drip with wine, the hills will flow with milk, all the watercourses of Judah will flow with water, and a spring will go out from the house of Hashem and water the valley of Shittim. Got it? Mm-hmm. Turn to one more book. Zechariah. So it's a little bit ahead. The end of Treyasar. Chapter 13. So you want page 1425. Chapter 13, sentence 1. There's an awful lot of water in our future. On that day, there will be a spring opened up for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem for cleansing and for purification. Chapter 14, sentence 8, on the next page. It shall be on that day, spring water will flow out of Jerusalem. Half of it will flow to the eastern sea, half of it to the western sea. This will be in summer and winter.
And everyone takes water to be literal water, not just...
Well, that's the question. What is the symbolism of all of this water? So I bring you source number 23. I like it when I can quote something that we did in Treyasar, because then I can go back and just cut and paste from my source sheets. So Rabbi Pinchas quoted Rav Huna of Tzipori, "The spring which will emerge from the Holy of Holies will resemble grasshoppers' antennae at first." This is like what, or antennae at first. This is like what we saw in Yechezkel. the widening of the body of water. When it reaches the entrance of the Heichal, it will be like the warp thread on a loom. When it reaches the Ulam, outer room, it will be like the woof thread. When it reaches the entrance to the Azara, to the temple, it will be like the mouth of a small jug, dot, dot, dot. I skipped some steps. From there, it will strengthen and increase until it reaches the entrance of the house of David, at which point it will be as a flooding river in which impure people immerse. And it goes on, it quotes the verses that we've been looking at. So there it sounds like it's, yeah, like water. And take a look at number 24, which also makes it sound like it's literal. Rabbi Yirmiyah sat before Rabbi Zera and said, in the future, God will produce a river from the Holy of Holies on which will be all manner of delicacy, as it is written, dot, dot, dot. So, do you have to take it literally? Could it be that it's not meant literally? So there are different ways to view it. The message may be about life, water representing life, right? That's one possibility. Agricultural plenty, the idea that you're going to have a ready supply of water. What else could it represent? Think about Torah, because why not? Water is Torah. We started today when we were looking at the elements from chapters 30 to 32 with water being Torah. Ashrechem Zorim Al Komayim. What else? Zorei Al Komayim. What else could you do? Look where the water is coming from.
Is it purification?
From the temple.
Right. It's purification, which was actually in a pasuk in one of the psukim that we read. But it's forgiveness. Rashi quotes from the Targum, right? It's coming from the altar where you bring your karbanot. Hashem is accepting your karbanot. So is that what we're doing with our water here? Is that what our water is about?
Well, our water was protective water also.
Right. Our water, I believe, is actually different. Even though Rashi links it to that, I think that this is actually describing different water. The difference is our water is protective. Our water surrounds the city. It's not emerging from the city. It's surrounding it. I brought you Radak. Take a look at source number 25, please, at Radak. He says, He will be for us a place of rivers. God, meaning, is going to provide rivers. As though there will be wide rivers surrounding Jerusalem, so that the enemies will not be able to cross. Even a great ship will not be able to navigate and cross this great river. And because Yeshaya compared the Assyrian camp to a great river in Yeshaya 8:7, which everyone, of course, remembers, he said that Hashem will be an even greater river for them, such that the Assyrian king will not be able to cross it and conquer Jerusalem. This is divine protection. And most commentators read it that way. Malbim has a different read, but most commentators read it as Radak does. And to me, this fits with something I mentioned when we started today, when we were looking back at 30 to 32. Go back to chapter 30. Go back to Yeshaya, please. Chapter 30, sentences 15 to 18. You want page 1005. Hashem says, I told you that I was going to take care of you. Right? But what have you done? You've been churning. You said, we're going to flee on a horse. So fine, go flee. We're going to ride on swift animals. Right? You insisted that you're going to be the one to take care of yourself. Instead of relying on Hashem, you should have relied on God for it. And now go back to chapter 22, at last, sentences 8 to 11. Page 989. This we discussed back in chapter 22. We tied it into other psukim about the defense of Jerusalem against the Assyrians. You saw that the breaches of the city of David were numerous, so you collected the waters of the lower pool. You counted the houses of Jerusalem, and you demolished the houses to reinforce the wall. You made a water reservoir between the two walls by the water of the old pool, but you didn't look towards the one who made this happen, nor did you consider the one who formed it in the distant past. Yeshaya is connecting across chapters. This is why it's so frustrating when people assume that Yeshaya is like many authors. It's all one theme. In chapter chapter 22, he said to you, stop trying to build moats. You're destroying houses in the city in an attempt to reinforce the wall and create a moat. In chapter 30, he said to you, don't do that. You're churning, trying to defend yourselves in all these ways. Rely on me. And in chapter 33, he says, because this is my promise to you, I'm going to be your moat. You don't need this. You don't need to build moats. Now, again, we already noted back when we saw chapter 22, Yeshaya is not against attempts at self-defense. He's against attempts at self-defense which seek to supplant the role of God, which is different. But that's what Yeshaya is doing. I thought the imagery of the water here is beautiful. And when I first read it, I was like, what is this? And then it hit me. So, major point here. How does all of this connect across from chapter 28 all the way through 33? What is the flow here from 28, 29, so to speak, where they're not listening to the prophets, where they don't want to learn, where they're self-indulgent and they drink and all of that, right, in 28, 29, to don't make your deals with the Assyrians, with the Egyptians, right? Where did this all fit? So there are a bunch of associations. I gave you a list on the sheet, which I want to just state briefly. We have 2 minutes. We can do it. We began by warning people to listen to the prophet, to the Navi, right? And that hoy included a promise of redemption. Here we're told how the redemption is actually going to happen via the justice of your King Chizkiyahu. We continued by warning, don't pursue alliances. Here we're told how the alliances are going to end. Those nations will not be able to withstand the Assyrians. It's not going to work. They're going to collapse also. And we are told here, don't rely, as we just said, on the moats of our defenses. There are also beautiful linguistic and imagery associated ways in which this echoes the previous chapters when it talks about the reversal of the power of the enemy. In 33:18, we said, Ayei soferet hamigdalim. Where is it who counts the towers? Radak and Malbim said that those towers represent the might of the Assyrians. In chapter 30, he talked about the water knocking down those Migdalim. So that's one bridge. There's also a knock, I think, on Uzziah and his Migdalim, but I'll leave that for another day. The enemy is described here in 33:19 as Am-Nil-Ag. Am-Nil-Ag. An enemy of thick speech. Belibina, without any understanding. That goes back to chapter 28, sentence 11. I should have put that on the sheet. I'll have to make sure to correct that when I upload it, because it should be there. In 28:11, we describe the speech of the teacher who can't get his message across and who is mocked as Lage Safa. Instead of your teachers being Nilag, the enemy is Nilag. Also, the theme of seeing. There's so much here in the end, in this chapter, about seeing. You're going to see the king. You're going to see your righteous leader, God. You will not see your enemy, is here in sentences 17 to 20. It's all about vision, as opposed to the inability to see in chapter 29, sentences 9 to 11. Do you remember that? In 29, 9 to 11, we talked about how you won't be able to see. Your eyes will be covered. Now, you will have vision. You will be able to see. So what you're getting here, and then of course the water, which we just referenced, what you're getting here in this hoy is putting paid to all of these things that happened in the previous hoys, in the previous warnings. This is how your redemption is going to come to pass, with a king who's going to lead you to justice, with a nation that's going to live that kind of life of justice, as Ibn Ezra noted. And then Hashem says, I'm going to take care of the rest. I will be your moat defending the city. And where you couldn't see before, now you're going to see. That's what's going on in this parak. There's more to be said, of course. But that's in a nutshell what's going on. I do want to come back to chapter 33, sentence 6 next time, because it's a pasuk that gets used in a beautiful way in the Gemara, but no one ever understands why the Gemara does what it does. And once you see it in context, you understand what the Gemara is doing. So I want to do that. and a nice closer from chapter 33, sentence 15, and then we'll move into the next chapters, which introduce us to the Assyrian invasion and Chizkiyahu's defense. Thank you very much.